WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
It wasn't long ago that same-gender dancing in Chicago was illegal and gay bars faced police raids. LGBTQ plus spaces continue to come under threat. That makes it all the more important to embrace queer joy. And there is a long legacy of this in Chicago, with Black queer folks leading the way. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. The tradition of Black queer nightlife in this city is marked with a great deal of creativity and resilience, and there are plenty of lessons to be learned across generations of organizers. To learn more, we recently spoke with Chicago Reader social justice reporter DMB, who dug through archives to chronicle this history. We also spoke with Pat McCombs, who for decades co-organized Executive Suite, that's a party primarily centering Black lesbians, and Dr. Nick Alder, who co-founded Party Noir, an inclusive cultural hub celebrating Black femmes, queer women of color, and Black womanhood along the gender spectrum. I started our conversation by asking DMB what Chicago's gay bar scene looked like back in the 50s and 60s. Here's DMB.
Before the 70s, before house music brought a lot of straight and gay people into the same spaces, before Stonewall, where queer people weren't no longer afraid of being arrested or jailed for cross-dressing or same-sex dancing. The queer scene in Chicago was under the radar. You wouldn't know it was a gay bar unless you knew it was a gay bar. The windows of all these establishments were either like one way where you can see out but they can't see in, or they were blackened. Oftentimes, the reason why many of these spaces were not just constantly raided by police is because they were owned by the mafia. Around the 1920s, mafia took control of the liquor business in Chicago after Prohibition. Mm-hmm. And even when Prohibition ended, they never really let go of it. So the mafia sort of owned and ran gay bars through the 80s. And it was because of this, there was a marginal level of safety that a lot of queer people had. The mafia would pay off the cops. You can come raid our bars a Wednesday at 3 p.m. when no one's here. Mm. So this was very much a way that all these queer gay parties could exist in secret.
Yeah.
Sometimes, even when they would raid, when the cops would come the night of a party, maybe the downstairs area would be a straight party and upstairs is a gay party. And all the queers are punching out the windows on the second floor and jumping out. Or maybe if some butches and femmes, this happened at the volleyball, went out dancing together, the femmes would bring some extra clothes so that if a raid happened, the butches could come and switch out their outfits so they wouldn't get arrested for cross-dressing. Mm. So there were all of these tips and tricks for
partying in disguise, it sounds like.
It's right? Still doing the same thing that we're doing today, just with like maybe the threat of cops coming in a lot higher.
Now, Pat, I mean, I want to hear your memories. You would have been first visiting gay bars in the late 60s. What are your first memories like, and do they sound like what DMB just described?
Yes, some with additional information, because we did a lot of stuff underground, so it's not like it's written. Most of the time we did stuff at people's houses, in their basements, and where you could feel free and dress any way you wanted to. But when you left the party, you had to really watch out, because if a woman had a zipper in front of her pants, they arrested her. So a lot of women went to jail because of zippers in front of their pants.
Oh, my.
Right. The zippers in the front were considered menswear. Rare. On the side was considered women's wear.
Right.
So gotcha.
A lot of them sometimes would turn their pants backwards, or they'd dress a certain way in order to feel protected once they left.
Right.
So back in the 60s, there was no visiting lesbian bars for you?
For me, I was too young. What bar did I go to? Oh, Well, I put it like this. It was a bar. It was called Betsy's.
Okay.
And it was very defined in terms of your role. You either had to be femme or stud. And you had to act a certain way. If you were feminine, you'd sit at the bar and just drink and wait for the more aggressive woman to buy your drinks and do different things. Mm-hmm. So you had to establish yourself, especially in the black community, as well as you had to act a certain way when you walked out. You couldn't really hold hands or show any type of affection with each other when you left that particular bar.
Do you remember the first time you walked into Betsy's and what that was like for you?
I was with the more aggressive woman, and she had chosen my outfit for the day. This is when I was young and didn't know better. And all I had to do was just sit at the bar. I was in shock because I thought I was going to party, but I had to sit at the bar and drink my mint julep or whatever she would buy for me, and just sit there while she ran around and flirted and did what she had to do, have fun. And I just felt like I was so inhibited, or, you know, that role, that strong role definition of how you were supposed to act.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't like. So as time went on, I did change that. But
yeah,
it was just a lot of underground stuff. You couldn't really do a lot other than sit there, at least films.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of hiding,
too. Yes, a lot of hiding.
A lot of hiding, you know, your reality.
Yeah. You know.
DMB, as you mentioned, you know, 1969 was when police raided Stonewall Inn and patrons kind of rose up and fought back. That was a gay bar in New York, but talk about how that reverberated into Chicago.
100%, yeah. So just as there was a gay liberation front group in New York City, we had a chapter here in Chicago, and their first goal was, let's boycott Normandy, this 500-capacity bar that is not allowing us to have same-sex dancing. They boycotted it for about 2 months until they forced the bar owners to go and get a permit to let the attendees do same-sex dancing, to wear shorts, to wear sunglasses, to let women sit at the bar. And this continued. So this is when one of the people I speak to, Suki De La Croix, he says this is when gays became uppity. So now they're kind of upset with the mob owners. They're like, this is too expensive what you're having us pay. Like, we don't want this. Like, we want our own bar. And then the mob is like, fine, whatever. You know, like, take the damn bar. And this is when gays started to own bars. They started to publicly name, this is a gay establishment. Yeah.
Nick, so the Stonewall riots were in June, and that's why we celebrate Pride this month. How do you keep the roots of Pride in mind as you're approaching creating space for Black queer joy in this day and age?
I mean, I think it has a lot to do with just continuing to be committed to the spaces that we create and to create safe spaces for Black and queer, trans and non-binary folks. And I think it feels particularly contentious to hold this question about, like, how to be committed to the riot or the movement of the work. Because as we see in recent years, Pride is corporatized. There are corporations who are bringing in lots of dollars to kind of support Pride in a very superficial way without being committed to the work in a real and substantial way. And I think it really is for us to just kind of continue to question and to push back and to demand more from these entities who want to sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, who want to benefit or to profit, honestly, off of the work of Black and brown queer folks.
Yeah, dig more into that for me, that superficial that you were talking about.
I mean, the superficial is that, you know, you Pride Month comes around, you change your logo to a rainbow, and maybe you give some money to your state's Pride Parade. But I don't know. I think to me, it just feels like you do the lip service, you do the work that makes it look like you are aligned or creating affirming space.
Like, it's performative.
Yes, you are performative in sort of your approach to supporting queer people. But as we're looking around the nation and seeing all of these anti-trans bills, all of the political landscape that is attacking Black and brown trans and queer folks, youth, young people, these corporations, I don't see them putting sort of the same work of actually advocating for these folks.
Speaking of advocating, in the 70s, Pat, you organized a protest against a white-owned lesbian bar for discriminating against women of color. What happened there?
We decided, a group of us, one of our sisters that was, we were all at a party, a gathering at a friend's house, and she stated that she had a hard time entering the bar because they asked for certain identification, which at the time was identification for people on public aid. And she assumed that people of color were on some type of public assistance. So I felt strongly insulted by it, and I gathered together. I spoke with some of my white ally friends, and I got together, and we decided to picket the bar on a weekend when they were making the most money. Mm-hmm. And a lot of women that came to the bar, they came from the suburbs and all over, and so when they saw all us black and white women picketing the bar, of course, they were afraid to go in. So one way you can really let a person know that you mean business is to make sure they don't make any money. And that has a great influence over various businesses when they realize they are missing out on profits. Mm. And so we picketed the bar, and I took them to human relations. And during the time we picketed the bar, I passed out flyers to let people know what to do in case they were discriminated against. We formed an organization called Black Lesbian Discriminative Investigative Committee, mainly because it sounded very important and it was nice. We had no idea what the world we were doing.
Big brain.
So it sounded good. So we put the bars on the north side on notice that we would be coming to their bars to see if mm-hmm. they discriminate against us at the door, which in the end result was that they established a type of signage they could present at the door, which would tell what was required in terms of identification, and that way not excluding us women of color.
And later you got involved in organizing Executive Suite.
Right.
Right? Describe the atmosphere of that party and the mission there.
Well, that came about because of discrimination. I said, why pay our money where people don't want us? So let's start our own thing. Mm-hmm. I said, I can make that money. So my friends and I, we would carry briefcases and dress up in suits and go to various establishments outside of our neighborhood, but in a central location. Like, most of our events were like downtown mm-hmm. or on the north side, where people didn't really want us, but they couldn't. I went to businesses that had poor business, put it like that. Uh-huh. We'd go on a Friday night and we'd walk in our suits and ask to speak to the owner and say, we see that you're not doing very well. You know, could we rent this establishment for the night? And usually they were very agreeable about it because they weren't making money anyway.
Right.
And I did let them know we were lesbians. I told them we were a sorority because at the time I was in the closet. And we were in a closet, bottom line.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't want them to know that we were a bunch of black lesbians coming to their establishment.
So what was that like, being partially in the closet but also trying to be an activist for some of the struggles that you and people like you were dealing with at the time?
Well, it was very difficult because I was teaching at the time. Mm. And so I had to keep that side of myself undercover. Sometime during that time, they would like to come and take pictures, and I would never take pictures. And I had a undercover name called Pat Love. So if I wrote anything or said anything, I'd say Pat Love, you know. It took me a long time. I think I was about in my 40s.
When you finally came out?
When I really came out to the public. Mm-hmm. Maybe 30, late 30s, 40s. Yeah, I wasn't out there early because I didn't want my job to know, you know. Work for the Board of Education. Everybody knows now.
Yeah.
But, so it was difficult. And we went to, like I said, we went to various establishments. And then we had certain rules that we had to go by. For instance, we wanted female bartenders, female security, and stuff like that.
Nick, how does Pat's experience resonate with you decades later?
I mean, the times have changed, but they haven't changed. So when you talk about sort of starting a space because of the kind of discrimination or not seeing yourself represented in a space, at the time that Party Noir started in about 2015, the center of queer life in Chicago is in Boys Town, and it's mm-hmm. very white. It's very male-centered, and for us, we just We wanted to see a space that represented and really centered and affirmed Black, queer, trans, non-binary people. Mm-hmm. We wanted that space to feel like when you walked in, you felt the care of Black femmes. Our party travels, but our home base is at the Promontory. And so our work has been, over the years, developing relationships with their bar staff, with their security. And while they might not be all women, they are folks who understand and help us to secure and to create this sense of just like centering Black queer folks. And to do so, it's taken a really long time. It's taken years.
And you're talking about Party Noir, which you started in 2015, and now you're doing this as you're also out in the streets protesting. Is that right?
Yes. So 2015, you know, the political landscape, it's not much different than what we're sitting in right now. If you think back to 2015, what was to come was that in 2016, we had an insane sort of presidential election. During that time, there's all sorts of, if you pick up your phone at any point in time, you're seeing headlines about Black youth, Black people dying, being murdered in the street, whether it's by cops or other state-sanctioned violence. And I was a part of a national organization, BYP 100, that was organizing on the South Side and doing a lot of organizing and movement work for Black liberation. I came to sort of this understanding that, like, we were doing a lot of important movement work, mm-hmm. and also putting our bodies under a lot of stress and just the trauma of being in protest, the trauma of being in sort of these positions with the police where you're being aggravated, you're being harassed, there's just violence being enacted on you. Mm. And we needed a space to release. We needed a space to gather. We needed a space to dance. And so some of the impetus or some of the influence for creating Party Noir, it's of course to create this place of celebration for Black queer folks that was not centered in Boys Town, but it was also really deeply connected to sort of this legacy where you can look throughout history and see, as long as there's Black movement work, there was also Black space making work that was happening, whether it be in bars and clubs, in spaces where you're sort of gathering around dance, whether it's like the house music scene here in Chicago and otherwise.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, DMB, as you were tracing this history, how did you see it impacting party organizers today?
One thing that drew me to create this story is I think that maybe me and maybe some of my peers, when you're going out, you're looking for somewhere to go, that a space that is catering to you as a trans person, as a Black person, as a Latinx person. Maybe you have this sense that, oh, this array of parties I can choose from is pretty new. Like, this is a 21st century thing. Like, this started happening in the past 8 years. I think we have a sense of scarcity when it comes to how far back the robust nature of, like, these parties were crazy back in the 60s, even if they were underground.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that maybe because, like, even though one party or one organization, like, might sunset, the next one pops up a few years later, and there's still, like, a consistent timeline. You're always able to find one at some point in Chicago history. And I think that another thing that might contribute to that perception is that as a new party organizer is starting, maybe the folk that they might have learned from closed their party a few years back, and there's no one being like, you two talk to each other about how to get it together. And they learn a few years into their party, like, oh, this actually, what I'm doing isn't new, even though I kind of felt alone when I was making this.
Yes.
And yeah. I think that's even like a bigger testament to how voracious these Black queer organizers are. Like, even when we're not able to be totally in tune with what that history looks like, we're still recreating it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nick, what was it like to discover the legacy of people organizing spaces centering around Black queer people?
I mean, when I met Pat McCombs and Vera Washington, I felt like I met myself in the future. I saw me in 50, 60 years. Mm. I saw what it meant to sustain a space and the legacy that I was like unknowingly sort of moving forward. Like DMB said, it wasn't that we created something that was brand new, but it was connected to this legacy and a very long legacy here in Chicago, where there's this intersection of creating safe space and movement work, or creating safe spaces and doing it for the love and the joy and the centering of Black lesbians, Black queer folks. I think to me, there's another space called Brunch Remix that was run by Renata. Renata's last name is escaping me.
Riddle.
Riddle.
Yes. Who now owns Nobody's Darling. And that was another space that at the time that I was creating Party Noir, so this is when we were in our infancy, probably our first or second year, I go to Renata's party and I'm like, look at the elders. And it just felt like a reaffirming, or just a reminder, or a reminder to just, first of all, keep going, and to just be a image, a visual, a representation of what this work could actually amount to should we actually stay the course.
Yeah. Pat, you talked about organizing the executive suite. Now, that party ran for decades.
40 years.
How do you keep that kind of sustainability? How do you keep that going?
You definitely have to have passion. And there was a need. The need just overwhelmed me, so I had to keep it going, because I knew that my followers were getting what they needed. We all wanted to have some space to meet other women. We wanted to enjoy ourselves. I wanted to make sure that it was a safe environment. Mm-hmm. We made sure that most of the places we rented were in a lit-up community. It was beautiful. The management treated us with respect. And parking. So those are the things that I looked at before I even rented certain spots. So I tried to make it as comfortable as possible, where the women would have a good time and feel safe. So that is one of the most important issues that I kept in mind while doing those parties.
Yeah.
As well as, because a lot of us were in the closet, we didn't have the internet. So when I would do my pluggers or my announcements for the party, it never had lesbians or lesbian party, anything like that. I did do the female symbol, but not the double symbol, which represented our lesbians. And when they received the mail at home, it was in envelopes, and they could feel comfortable with coming to an event. So our name, Executive Suite, became synonymous with lesbians. So most people knew of Executive Suite.
I see.
You see, that's how.
Yeah. You're coming up on your 10th year of Party Noir, Nick. How has Party Noir evolved?
I mean,
how do you keep that going?
In some ways, you know, I think about who I was 10 years ago and who I am today. At that time, I may have identified maybe more as a lesbian, a Black lesbian. And so it's this personal evolution of identity for me, mm-hmm. and Party Noir still being a home that can house every version of me, and then every version of, let's say, the different community members who have come in and out of our space over the last 10 years. And I think about some of the points that Ms. Pat just mentioned around just like safety and being thoughtful and intentional about like what it is that you're actually trying to create. And of course, you know, there's those logistical aspects of safety. So where it's located, who are the people that are interfacing with your community members? Do they know to sort of like use expansive gender pronouns when they're engaging or talking to folks? And then there are these other key components that have helped us to sort of like be clear about who we are and what our mission is.
Yeah.
And so before each party, we share in many different mediums Party Noir's mission, so that when you know that when you're entering our space, you're committing to holding this space and creating a safe space alongside with us. It's not just us who are responsible. It's a co-creation. It's us. We are in relationship with each other. Yeah. And then that has evolved over time. So we didn't just come out the gate having a mission. We had to develop that because there was a need. It was an iterative process of us recognizing that this is something that we needed to say, and we needed to say it often. And then there are these other, a few other components that I want to mention, our safety line, or the way that you can kind of get in touch with us. So there's a phone number. We also share a QR code that when you're in our space and you experience anything at all and you need to contact us, you can do so and you can do it immediately. And those are some of the things that have sort of evolved and developed over time to be able to just continue to meet the need. So of course, like, yeah, we're here for joy and we're here for celebration, but we also want to be sure that we are creating as much as a safe and affirming space that we can possibly create.
That's a good blueprint for others to follow going forward.
Blueprint. Say it again.
Yes, blueprint. DMV, how do you feel like different generations can learn from each other?
I think on one hand, it's realizing on both sides that your experience isn't terminally unique. Like, there are so many through lines there. And then I think maybe making the assumption that there are more connections than not, and then looking to see how the times, how technology, how the way social and political changes have shifted how you do the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. So before I let you all go, I'm going to go around the room and just ask what you hope for the future of Black queer spaces in Chicago. You first, Pat.
The future of Black queer spaces?
Your hopes.
My hope is that there are more of them, and that more inclusive in terms of age-wise, which it isn't at this time. But I think that has to do with personal. I mean, once you get a certain age, certain things you just don't do. But having that as some type of way to interlock that community so that as we do age, we don't feel left out. Mm-hmm. Because just because we age doesn't mean we no longer want to party.
Right.
So trying to combine that and just being able to come to various spaces and celebrate all of ourselves at any age.
Yeah.
Just being able to have those type of spaces where we can feel comfortable and yet we can share a lot of different things with each other.
What about you, DMB? Your hope for the future of the spaces?
My hope for the future of these spaces... Well, first, I hope for the diversity of the Black queer spaces to expand, the gender diversity, the genres of bands and music that are playing, just for people to continue to see us on the wide spectrum that we exist on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hope for perhaps the sustainability financially to be available through the city or through grants. Or I'm hoping there's a way for those spaces to financially
More resources
sustain themselves. Yeah. You said it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nick?
So I think about that intergenerational connection and maybe what we're doing right now, this kind of reconnecting to the legacy so that the folks who are coming after, there's an understanding that like, you are connected to an actual legacy. This isn't something that is brand new, and that there are some blueprints, there are some maps, there are some wayfinders that have kind of tread the path before you. And I think an abundance of resources. I think about our conversation today is about sort of like the moving party or the pop-up or the party that floats. And there's that question of ownership and what it means to have access to physical space here in Chicago. And it's very hard. It's a challenge. And I'm thinking about some like imaginative ways to kind of be in ownership, whether it's co-ops or us being able to sort of like have resources that don't necessarily sort of map on to the very kind of like capitalistic landlord, owner, et cetera. But there are ways for us to kind of be in community and to cultivate the space and be stewards of the space together, whether that's sort of like brick and mortar or some wild thing that I haven't yet dreamed of.
Right.
It could be like a homestead or some piece of land that we are all kind of stewarding together to create space for Black creativity and Black queer trans non-binary creativity.
We've been talking about the history of Black queer nightlife in Chicago and how it impacts the present day with Chicago Reader reporter DMB, along with party organizers Pat McCombs and Dr. Nick Alder. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shasha.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Max Lubers. It was edited by Meha Ahmed. To stay up to date with the stories and news in Chicago, make sure to subscribe to our podcast and head over to wbez.org/reset for a full archive of our interviews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening, and tune in again this afternoon.
Love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.